Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Very busy one, especially in places like Madison, Wisconsin. A minute and a half past the hour, we begin a brand new week of live liberal conversation radio on the horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, in case you didn't know, because we do, in fact, have new listeners from time to time. Well, frankly, we have new listeners all the time, and that's kind of exciting. We're pretty much done with February here in the Hills and Hollers, and you may already be done with February wherever you are. I think John Fox is done with February down in Australia. It appears to be that March will come in like a lion here in the hills, which is a good thing because that means maybe we'll get winter over with and start thinking about things like spring. Not so young talk show host's fancy turns to thoughts of, oh, I don't know, more conversation radio. How's that? Sure, why not? But it is the end of the month, and it is still February here. And I would be remiss if I did not throw a little something out there for your consideration. Tonight, between now and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, in other words, the next 2 hours and 58 minutes or so, we need 24 people. 24 people. That's all. Just 24 people to pony up $10 apiece. That works out to less than 5 cents per program. Less than 5 cents an hour, I should say. Less than 5 cents an hour per program. In order to make the Horn's fundraising goal for the month of February. And frankly, this is kind of important to me because, well, it's always important for us to make the fundraising goal, but it's significant, shall we say, for a particular reason. It will be the first time in God knows how long that the Horn has, 2 months in a row, met its fundraising goal. Having 2011, which is working out kind of oddly on other fronts, but having it work out so that we are able to say that we're in the black 2 months, the first 2 months of the year, that's huge. That's just huge. So 24 people between now and 9 p.m., or now and midnight, actually, 24 people, and the Horn has made its fundraising goal for the month of February. Can you help with that? Can you be part of that? It would be wonderful if you could. And so many of you already have. We are, one of these days, we will actually have the whole complement of the Thrifty 250, and this will just, all these little pitches and stuff will just go away because you'll know. It's the first of the month, it's the middle of the month, it's the last of the month. Kick in $10, be part of the 250, and boom, we're done. And for those who may be new to the listening process, let me reiterate, this is about operating expenses and not about lining anybody's pockets. If we were trying to line people's pockets, believe me, the monthly fundraising goal would be closer to $15,000. But it's just $2,500. That's all. I had a nice brief conversation with Ben Birch. He says he thinks he's got the gremlins and nastiness sorted out of the system, so there shouldn't be any future problems. Hopefully, fingers crossed, not knocking, but pounding on wood. And some of the stuff that's tormented us over the last few weeks may well be gone away. Because our side is smarter than their side. Isn't that nice to realize? Because we really are. They're loud, they're noisy, they're hateful, they're violent, they're pig-headed, they're jug-eyed and stupid. But we're smarter. We are smarter. Hallelujah for that, huh? Before we dive into the meat of the program tonight, let me jump into something here. It's a message for you. I was specifically asked to share this with you during the beginning of the program. It comes to you from our blogger, Texas Betsy. And she just says, "Dear Bob, as you know, I usually help out in the chat room for the first hour on Mondays and Tuesdays, and often other days, especially when I know Lottie will be arriving late," Lottie, of course, being the moderator of our chat room. "What you and the listeners may not know is that I do that after 2 hours of paperwork for the high school, 90 minutes of teaching my ninth graders, after a fifth grade tutoring student, before my weekly sixth grader arrives." Whew. Says Texas Betsy, though, "Not today. Not today, though. My apologies. Might make it in for the first 15 minutes if I get everything else taken care of quickly. Today, I'm going to a rally in the dim hopes of saving my job. I received a RIF, R-I-F, letter last week." Remember RIF, reading is fundamental? "I received a RIF letter last week after 13 years with the school district. I have a master's degree and 22 years of experience in my field. With barely a whimper, the Austin Independent School District announced budget cuts recently that will eliminate over 1,000 jobs. The difference in reaction between this right-to-get-fired state and the unionized Wisconsin is more extreme than the difference between a Texas summer and a Wisconsin winter. Our cuts have received no national press." Okay, that's kind of like the weekend coverage of the Madison rallies. "But also very little local press. There is almost no organized protest, and I'm afraid to see how few people attend the rally in front of school district headquarters this evening at 6:30 Central Time." That'll be 7:30 our time, halfway through the program. Maybe if she's so inclined, Betsy could give us a call from the site. "There were flyers from the local AFT affiliate," that's the American Federation of Teachers, "of which I am a member, in every staff member's mailbox last Thursday and again today, but I did not hear a single conversation about tonight in my travels around the building, nor did I see any email, carpool, rides, arrangement inquiries. There were no large signs at the school entrances. Most of my colleagues do not know that I am on the list because the entire process is being treated as if there were a taint of shame. Haven't told half my friends. I'm barely tweeting, blogging, or Facebooking my status on the RIF list, in part because I tend to try to wish away the bad news in my life, and in part because I am ashamed of facing unemployment at this point in my career." Jesus. "I have been an advocate for my students since the first day of my first student teaching experience in 1989. But it is only in the past year that I've begun to advocate fiercely for myself as well. Tonight, I take that advocacy to the streets of downtown Austin. I hope that others show up as well. Betsy." Pictures of signs. "Save our jobs. Use the rainy day fund. We stand together. Kids matter. Teachers matter. Save our jobs." Local TV in Austin reported the following. "At Tuesday night's AISD bond meeting, there was no discussion of school closures or layoffs. However, those subjects were still very much on the minds of parents who attended. I know several teachers who got notices that their jobs or positions were being eliminated," said Lori Barzano, the parent of an AISD student, Austin Independent School District. "Monday night, the district announced more jobs would be eliminated. Now, 1,104 positions are among the proposed cuts, which would save," that word, $58 million. That's 92 more positions than the district announced earlier this month. I hope that the last people that they hand the pink slips to are the ones that deal directly with our children, said Barzano. Sorry, Ms. Barzano. That's exactly who they handed the pink slips to. What stuck in my mind as I read Texas Betsy's email was what she mentioned about feeling ashamed. And so I direct these remarks not only to Texas Betsy, but to anybody who has ever been let go from a job or has recently been let go from a job through no fault of their own. There is no shame you should feel. Anger, fury, wrath. Feel that in it. Feel a surfeit of all of those. But feel no shame. And we are all in this together. And we all will work through this together. We are our only hope. We are our only hope. There is no shame in being, no. The only thing, and I'll say this directly to Betsy, the only thing you could be ashamed of, in my opinion, is if you laid there and took it. If you just stood there and let them do you in and said, oh, well, and walked away. But you're not doing that. You're going to the rally tonight. And you're going to make a difference. And you're going to make your voice heard. And for that, you should, no, shame should not enter into the equation. Be proud of what you are doing this evening. Be proud that you are standing up for yourself. Be proud. And be unflinching. Because from 99ers on down, I hope that the vast majority understand why it is this is happening. This stuff is happening, in short, because everybody, one, two, three, they want it all. And they think, the Republicans think, they are in easy reach of having it all. Yesterday on Press the Meat, I believe it was, Richard Trumka, NBC, finally found somebody from labor to have on the panel instead of some godforsaken teabag and right-wing, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, oatmeal-dribbling, house helmet herring wearing weirdo. Haley Barbour was on alongside Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO. And Haley Barbour was babbling along about how the public employees, workers need to give up a little bit to save the taxpayers some money. Richard Trumka looked at him and said, Haley, public employees are taxpayers. And that encapsulated something right there. Because, of course, the for-profit media is going right along with all the right-wing talking points, making it sound as though public employees, government workers, so forth, are something besides taxpayers, that they are somehow a pernicious leech that has been affixed to the wasted body of our body politic. And that is, of course, utter and unmitigated bullshit. Oops, sorry. Public employees are the people who make our schools work, who answer the famous question by George W. Bush, is our children learning? Yes, George, and probably considerably more so than you ever did, you miserable son of privilege. Our children are learning, and they learn because of dedicated educational professionals that the right wing now wants to throttle. This is all a con, and no one seems to be, well, not no one, obviously, we're talking about it. This is all a right-wing con, and the fact of the matter is, most of this so-called problem could have been solved and prevented had that pig-eyed, jug-eared little lout, George W. Dimson, Dim Leader, not run off and started two wars of choice off the books and on the credit card after having given away a surplus and given away my grandchildren's future. It's a fact. If America's rich would pay what they duly ought to in a nation that has a progressive taxation philosophy, this so-called problem would not exist. And, of course, I guess it's to be understood that, well, I mean, I hope we understand that that's the nature of the con. This has been the Republican goal all along. Create a crisis and then solve the crisis by destroying their political enemies. It's as plain as damn day, isn't it? I should hope so. I should hope so. And they're still at it. This little space alien looking Gomer from Indiana, Mitch Daniels, says that the government must continue slashing spending, and these are his words, not mine, even if they end up seriously costing a lot of jobs. NPR's Steve Inskeep asked Governor Daniels if budget cuts should still go forward, even if they would result in widespread job losses. Here's the quote. Inskeep. I want to ask something that a lot of people are confronting right now as they deal with the federal deficit as well as state and local deficits that need to be closed. Are budget cuts, government budget cuts, worth it, even if they end up seriously costing a lot of jobs right now? Mitch Daniels didn't even take a beat. He didn't even bat an eye. Daniels, the answer is yes. Even an outfit like Goldman Sachs, as Think Progress has documented, even an outfit like Goldman Sachs has said that giving the repiglickens in the House of Representatives their head and letting them take the bit in their teeth and go slash and burn crazy would cause a gross domestic product drop of somewhere between 1.5% and 2%. Newsflash, that's a lot. Center for American Progress economist Adam Hirsch says that that would also result in at least a 1 percentage point rise in the unemployment rate. What the Repiglickens are advancing is a scenario that would create nearly 1 million jobs lost. Isn't this sickening? Isn't this simply disgusting? To watch a political party in this country that has claimed the mantle of national security and patriotism and mourning in America as its own, wrapped itself in the flag and festooned itself with Bibles, watching them for nothing more than simple, sleazy political gain, watching them advance an agenda that will cost a million working people their jobs. A million more! A million more. And for what? Political gain. Stinking, dirty, rotten, filthy, repugnant, pornographic, obscene political gain. It is, if it weren't Republicans, I would say that it was amazing to behold. Now, Wisconsin Governor Snot Walker has reached a point of brassiness after the events of the weekend in which police refused to evict protesters from the Wisconsin State House. Walker showed up on Press the Meet the Prestitutes. He also showed up on a statewide Wisconsin news magazine show called Up Front with Mike Gosha, might be pronounced Smith, G-O-U-S-H-A. By the time he got there, Snot Walker had decided that, or his message managers and image managers, well, now what? Now the legislation he's proposed, it is merely a budget repair bill. Budget repair. Merely smear some budget repair on your budget. Put up down a piece of wax paper and iron over it with a warm iron, and your budget will be repaired. Budget repair. It's a budget repair bill. And what's more, not only is it merely a budget repair bill, it doesn't even end collective bargaining for workers. Oh, hell no. Don't believe me. Listen for yourself.
Do you see any need for public employee unions in this state?
Philosophically?
If I didn't, I wouldn't have narrowed it down to just collective bargaining. I would have eliminated collective bargaining all over.
Do you think about that?
We looked at every option, but in this case, we said we could narrow it down, still have a role for collective bargaining, still have a role for public employee unions, but cap it in so that the taxpayers aren't trumped out by the decisions we currently see with the collective bargaining law.
You hear that? There it is again. As if there is a difference between public employees and taxpayers. As if a school teacher doesn't pay state, federal, local, municipal, county, whatever, income taxes. As if public employees don't pay into Social Security. As if they are literally leeches placed on the body politic. There's no difference between taxpayers and public employees. Public employees are taxpayers. But yes, it eliminates collective bargaining. And yes, it is filthy and sleazy. So, we can certainly discuss some of that this evening. By the way, Mitch Daniels says that when he said that, oh, yeah, absolutely, cut the jobs, even if it means massive job losses. Well, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty and presumed GOP presidential candidate, well, he says, and this is really kind of a Marie Antoinette moment for him, he appeared for an interview with Think Progress. And he said, as to a government budget, as to a government shutdown, if it came down to it and it was between that and not getting the budget headed in the right direction, that's an option I think Republicans have to consider. But here's the Marie Antoinette moment. We've got to get back to certain principles and responsibilities and start. Don't you love those principles and responsibilities? Every time a Republican wants to talk about principles and responsibilities, we end up bleeding. We've got to get back to certain principles and responsibilities, and starting with getting the budget balanced, and if it takes it, here. And if it takes a dramatic moment, or a dramatic week, or a dramatic month, those kinds of line-in-the-sand moments are what we need to get politicians back up against the wall and have them make the tough decisions. But you see, there's no politicians who won't be able to feed their families. No. It's working people who will pay for the dramatic moments. How can you talk about dramatic moments after witnessing what's been happening in Libya? That's plenty dramatic, isn't it? Is that what Tim Pawlenty wants? Is that what Tim Pawlenty means by drama? A little blood in the streets? A little cold water on the back of the neck in the code? Jesus. And that takes me back to something else. I'm still upset. All week long, or all weekend long, I've had on my mind what happened in Philadelphia last week, when two children, ages 7 and 9, were allowed to burn up in their home because fiscal hawks, deficit conservatives, budget conservatives, financial fiscal conservatives insisted that fire services be curtailed in the city of Philadelphia. Because, you see, that marks twice in 2 months when Republican policies have prevented a 9-year-old from becoming a 10-year-old. And that makes my blood run cold. What is it? What does the Republican Party have against 9-year-olds? First, the ammunition capacity of magazines in Tucson kept a 9-year-old from becoming a 10-year-old. And last week in Philadelphia, budget priorities and the need to cut the budget and be responsible made sure that another 9-year-old will not become a 10-year-old. And you see, that's when it dawned on me. The Republican Party killed those two children in Philadelphia as surely as if they had lit the match and thrown it. They did. Every single human being who has ever voted for a Republican candidate, at least in the last 2 years, especially in Pennsylvania, owns a piece of the murder of these two innocent children. Own it! By God, own it!
I voted for Republican because they want to save marriage from the queers. I voted for a Republican because they stand proud for America's fighting men and women instead of them sissy Democrats.
You voted for a Republican, and you got death. The death of a 7 and a 9-year-old little girl in return. And that is the typical return on investment of any given Republican vote. Republican votes yield death. Republicans are political, economic arsonists in our society. That's what's happening with all of these budget debates. Every last one of them. Whether it's Wisconsin or Texas or anywhere else. What we have are GOP firebugs watching the sparks strike the fabric of our society and crying, "Burn, baby, burn!" Whether it be Wisconsin, New Jersey, Ohio, Texas, Pennsylvania, burn, baby, burn! And why? Why? Because they want it all. They want it all. And the question is whether you will let them have it. I'll do my part. And I have no doubt whatsoever that you will do yours. Not for yourself. Not for yourself. But for the generations yet to come, and many as yet undreamt of. And there is only way, there is only one way we will have any success with any of this. And that is upon the recognition that no man is an island unto himself, that we are all a part of the whole, that we are diminished, as the poet said, by the losses of others, that in fact we are all in this together. This is The Horn.
Woke up this morning, I suddenly realized we're all in this together. I started smiling, 'cause you were smiling, and we're all in this together. I'm made of atoms, you're made of atoms, and we're all in this together. And long division just doesn't matter, 'cause we're all in this together. Yeah. I saw you walking in the city, we're all in this together. The city's changing, 'cause we are changing, and we're all in this together. Every 12 seconds, someone remembers that we're all in this together. In the kitchen of your rent control apartment, we're all in this together. Come on, baby, I don't mean to rush you. Reach out and touch you. I've got to start to open my heart. I know you think about jumping ship before it sinks, but we are all in this together. Ask a scientist, it's quantum physics, we are all in this together. And on the subway, We feel like strangers, but we're all in this together. Yeah, I love you and you love her and she loves him, but we are all in this together. You know, baby, there's never been protection in all the history of human connection. Come on, darling, it's all right to show.
Too. That's cool. Ben Lee, we're all in this together. Seemed appropriate, you know what I mean? Email just came in from Ron in Raleigh. He asked, but will they own it? Talking about trying to make Republicans own their actions. And Ron says, you know, I spent over 3 hours today in the fourth circle of hell, otherwise known as the DMV. Oh, I've got a DMV story. Maybe we'll get to it. A nice lady and I began talking. As the conversation wore on, she began to mouth the usual conservative talking points. As I usually do, I started to lay waste to that BS. People, it seems, have a gaping hole in their logic circuits. The fact that public service workers pay the same taxes that they do seems not to register. I tried to explain why the estate tax was not a problem for the working class, but the lady adamantly refused to see the obvious correctness of my argument. No matter what pain derives from the Repiglicans' slash-and-burn budget cuts, they will not own it. Thus saith Ron. Me, I tend to think we can make them own it, but we can only do it if we talk about it. We can only do it if we confront them with it. Now, just because I say confront doesn't mean that I mean, hey, you, knuckle walker, mouth breather, put down the oatmeal spoon, get the house helmet off from around your ears. Doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes it's just a matter as simple as what Ron did. Not listening to right-wing BS. And just letting it float around out there as if it was correct. Sometimes you just can't nod your little head anymore. Although I admit, and maybe I'll get around to this story, I was guilty a little of that this past Saturday. You'll see what I mean. But right now, and the lines are open, by the way, 877-443-2366, 877-4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Jump right in. The conversation's fine. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hey, Juanita.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree with what you were talking about. Everything. and they are guilty of it. They talk about abortion all they want to, but they're guilty of murder. And they
maybe that's one of the ways we address it, Juanita. You know, are you pro-life? Oh yeah, I love them little fetuses and the blastocysts and the embryos. I just love them. How do you feel about 9-year-olds?
Right, right.
And then
well,
Go ahead.
I just remember when Huckabee, you know, was saying that. You remember when the fire people was out and the guy's house was on fire and they wouldn't put it out because he hadn't paid $50 or something?
Right.
And Huckabee is saying, well, they were right. He should have paid it. You know, I don't comprehend that. I just can't think that way. I don't know. But it's like you do try to talk to people and it's like a glaze goes over their eyes, you know?
I've seen that, Juanita. When that glaze comes over their eyes, it's almost like a circuit is being tripped.
Yeah.
And all the right-wing talking points are just being, you know, all that right-wing filth is just oozing through what passes for their brains.
Well, I sent you an email, I don't know if you got it, about the guy in Georgia wanting to declare miscarriages.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week.
You did, but I didn't hear that. Sorry. Then I won't talk about it. I want to talk about the people in Wisconsin. And
okay.
Also, I want to say that this weekend, again, no coverage.
No, very none. Next to none.
And I wanted to say about, first of all, they were trying to say they were getting them out of the building. I think they finally got them out of the building, didn't they?
I was seeing on Twitter later, not too long ago, a report from a person in Wisconsin saying, no, everybody's not gone. Still lots of people in the Capitol.
They were talking about they had to clean the building. Well, the people cleaned the building. They took the children, the kids had to clean it. They kept that building clean. And I don't know if anybody's that's been reported or not, but, well, I guess it was somewhere. I wouldn't have known about it. But they've kept that building clean.
Yeah, they've taken very, because it's a public building. It belongs to the public.
Yeah. And then another thing, they did, like you said, they pay taxes. They're taxpayers.
Yeah.
And then the people are saying, well, we're paying for their public workers and we're paying for their hospitalization and all that kind of junk. Well, the thing is about unions is the desire, what the unions try to help is for everybody to have that. Not just the public workers, but for everyone.
And that seems so very obvious, doesn't it, Juanita?
Yeah, it does. But anyway, I guess they want to go back to the 30s or even the 50s. I mean, in the 50s, you had to work 6 days a week. It really, John Kennedy was the one that, you know, that had to get the 40-hour week in and the minimum wage and all. I remember because it was back in my day. And I hated working on Saturday. I'll tell you that. But you had to work on Saturday. I mean, and that was doing better than what my parents had to do.
Oh, yeah, because they might get tired. They worked a 7-day week and might get off, a little bit of church on Sunday.
Yeah. And I just wanted to, you know, speak up for these people. I think these people I'm so proud they represent us and all the people all over the country. You know, we've got decent people. We just don't know about it. All they let us see are the...
Right. And Juanita, why is it we don't necessarily know about it? Well, the for-profit media doesn't cover them.
That's right. Absolutely. Oh, I don't know what I wanted to say, too. That made me think about it. you were talking about John Stewart today. Well, let me put my take on that.
Do please.
Well, you have a great admirer of John Stewart. And then I watched that thing they had in Washington. And the thing is, you know, about everybody getting along, that's great if everybody did. But we have always give more than, I mean, they don't give. We always give.
That's our job.
You know what I'm saying? And we don't have people speaking up for us. But I'll tell you what really took the cake with me on him was Rachel Maddow interviewed him.
Yeah, that was kind of, yeah.
You saw that?
Oh, yeah.
And it just made me feel strange.
Well, and he came on there pleading that, well, you know, I don't feel good. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, built-in excuse.
But the thing is that.
Well, I mean, let's.
He was trying to say, we don't have the people speaking up for us. And we don't tell lies. I mean, there might be a few people, but we don't tell lies on them like they do us. Their whole thing is lies. Everything is lies. But I was really disappointed in him. I haven't felt the same about him since.
Well, but remember, okay? His brother, as I noted on the program, I mean,
yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, John Stewart. John Stewart is.
Yeah.
He really does have an agenda. It's sort of liberal, but not liberal like you and I are liberal, Juanita.
No.
You can't really be that way when your brother runs the New York Stock Exchange.
Well, and you think, and you're saying that, oh, we should all be nice. Well, we've been nice. We're very nice people. We've been too daggum nice. There comes a time you got to quit it. Stop it.
God, Juanita.
Well, you know, I've had to learn that the hard way. That was one thing the church did a number on me when I was a kid, was I thought that you should never get mad about anything, you know. And I would try so hard. Because I came from a volatile family on my daddy's side. They were very volatile and argumentative, you know, and sometimes even fist fights. And I was really trying to be a good girl, you know.
Oh, turn the other cheek.
Me up royally. And I learned the hard way that, yeah, if Jesus got mad, he got real mad. He took a whip to the people. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and lest we forget, the people that Yeshua took the whip to were the equivalent in that day of the J.P. Morgans and Goldman Sachses.
Oh, yeah.
Of his world.
Yeah, right.
You know, money changers.
Absolutely. Oh, he never put down anybody but them. He called them vipers. Oh, he told them that they were the sons of the devil, and they said, no, we're the sons of Abraham. He said, well, if you were the son of Abraham, you'd know me. And, you know, and it's just like today, you know, them talking, Fig Newton, whatever his name is.
What, huh?
They insult Fig Newton because I like him.
I do, too. I'm not sure I'm following.
Newton. Newt Gingrich.
Oh, Newt Gangrene. Newt Gangrene.
Yeah.
Yeah. The serial wedder.
And that him getting up and saying that, well, I believe in a forgiving God when that girl called him out on it, you know, at college.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, you know, have you heard his second wife, what she said about him?
Oh yeah, you know the other night, Juanita.
He got her dirty.
Yeah, the other night, Juanita. One of the channels ran one of my favorite films, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I don't know that one.
Oh, you've never seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I don't know what is.
Oh, Juanita, we got to remedy this in a straight up hurry. You have got to see Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Seen it.
It's a retelling of the Odyssey, you know, Ulysses, you know, only it's set in rural Mississippi during the Depression.
Oh, goodness, that sounds...
George Clooney plays the lead.
Oh, is that where he sings?
Yeah, Man of Constant Sorrow.
Oh, brother, where
art thou? Yeah.
Art thou?
And there's a moment when his two accomplices, Delmer and Pete, they come across a camp meeting and baptize him down by the river.
Yeah.
And the two of them, Delmer and Pete, run down, and the preacher dunks them, and they come away with their sin all washed away.
Yeah.
And they're driving along in the car a little bit later, and they say, Everett, you should have come down and got baptized with us. We're washed in the blood. We're clean. We've been forgiven. All of our sins are washed away. And then George Clooney, and this is the part that grabbed me and what reminded me. He turns around. He doesn't turn around. He says, fellas, your sins are washed away in the eyes of the Lord, but the laws of Mississippi are considerably more rigorous.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
And that's the thing about Newt Gingrich. Well, I believe in a forgiving God. Well, that's great, Newt, but the laws of our culture are considerably more rigorous.
Well, his second wife, she said that she asked him, you know, when he was still with her, and she knew he was cheating on her, and she asked him, why, how can you get up there and say stuff about Bill Clinton and about, you know, and you're living the way you're living? And he said, well, I don't have to live it. I just have to tell people what to do. You know.
Yeah. Do as I, well, I mean, but we've all been there before, right, Juanita? That's just a fancy way of saying do as I say and not as I do.
Yeah.
But oh, okay. Wait. Hold on. We had an email come in from Marty. He says, now wait just a centon. What did Newt's second wife say about Nudie? So tell the story, Juanita.
Well, that was it. She came out with, and he really tried to trick her out of getting any money, too. He told her he wanted her to go along, you know, and not say anything and see if she hadn't. He knew this law where she wouldn't have gotten anything. That's what she said, that she knew he was doing all these things, and he was getting up and talking about family values and all like that. That's what it was all about. And she said she said something.
Well, that was certainly interesting. Something very ugly just happened to the electricity here. We have had, in case you didn't know, because, you know, you probably don't get up every day and just check the weather in West Virginia. We just had a really nasty power surge. Stand by for a moment, please. Oh, dear. Okay, well, we got problems here. I'm going to let the phones reboot. Everybody who was on hold, you are no longer on hold. You will have to wait a couple of minutes while the phone system reboots, and then we can get you back into line. The dialing right now is not going to help because it takes a couple of minutes for the phone system to cycle through. It's just another computer, you know. Yeah, there you go, Marty. There you go. Oh, I'm sorry, Bob. I didn't mean to anger the Dark Lords of the Sith. See what can happen? Look, there's never a dull moment around here. My internet connection has held pretty steady. Oh, Jesus. Knocking wood. And our servers are holding steady. It looks like Ben's fix worked. But by golly, there is always one thing out there that just doesn't... Jesus. But, you know, that's one of the reasons we fundraise like we do, because when things die and we don't have the money to fix them, you know, that's what happens. Looks like the phone lines are going to light up again. Just stand by a couple of minutes and we'll get right back to it. In the interim, before I do go back to the phones, a little something came in from our buddy Spike. And what he says is absolutely true. So I think it's more than appropriate that I do this. Spike wrote in and he said, Bob, I never ask you to plug what I do in the racing media, so keep that in mind as I do just that. And I'm more than happy to help with this. Spike says, tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time, following your show, my buddy Jeremy Scott and I will be interviewing Ryan Hunter Ray for the IZOD IndyCar series. Ryan, just like myself, lost a parent when he was 28 to cancer. For him, it was his mother. For me, I was 29, and it was my father. Last year, he started a charity for cancer called Racing for Cancer to raise funds in the fight, a search for a cure, and helping those affected by it. They're looking for $28 donations from fans. Also, a guy named Tom Vossman is riding a bike to St. Pete, Florida now, 100 miles a day to raise money for it. The show is called The Inside Groove at racefanradio.com. There's a big old long link that go to racefanradio.com and look for The Inside Groove, racefanradio.com. And Spike makes a very important point. He says, unlike NASCAR, where drivers and teams only support charities when they pay the drivers and the teams, like Jeff Gordon with AARP's charity to end starvation among the elderly, RHR is not making a profit from this. He's doing this in the memory of his mother. I just happened to be at the press conference last summer. They announced this charity's formation. It touched me, and I think any race fans who listen to the horn might like to hear this. About RHR. He was the lone American driver to win an IndyCar race last season, Grand Prix of Long Beach, California. His soon-to-be wife is also the sister of NASCAR bad boy former IndyCar driver Robbie Gordon. Thanks, says Spike. So that's racefanradio.com, The Inside Groove, right after this show goes off tonight. Ryan Hunter Ray will be the interview subject. Yeah, Juanita, I'm sorry, we did get disconnected. It wasn't your fault. Our phone system got whacked. So we'll have another go at it on another evening, okay? And yeah, the stream stayed up. Ron confirming he'll streaming. Hey Bob, fill a Bobster away. You guys, you're impossible. I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get things started on an even keel. We'll start over with a brand spanking fresh new hour. We'll take a little break here right quick and come back to your phone calls at 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. And email, of course, now that I found out that Google did not wipe out my email account earlier today. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate that. Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, is the email address if you want to add something without necessarily making a phone call. You can do that. So a little music, a couple of messages, and then we're right back at it. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I paid a price, and I'll keep paying.
attention! Buy a soldier a shower!
Sir, yes, sir!
Buy a soldier a shower!
Sir, yes, sir!
Do something sweet for the troops. Choose from a selection of Bubble Genius bath and body products, and we'll send them to soldiers overseas on your behalf. The holidays are coming up. Buy a soldier a shower.
BubbleGenius.com.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
All better now, I hope. Really. 3 minutes past the hour, and we'll just call this a little in-game reset, if you don't mind. And what we'll do in short order is to go back to the phones. Does that work for you? Works for me. Hey, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Pretty good, Susan. What's up?
Well, first of all, I wanted to tell Betsy, 2004, my job was sent out of the country, not for anything I did, but for... $5. $5 an hour.
Jesus.
That's the difference between what they were paying me, which was $12 an hour. God, what a princely sum. And
yeah, don't spend it all in one place.
Yeah. The $7 an hour they were going to pay some fisherman off the street in Canada. Assuming they could train him, which it turned out they couldn't.
So that job then went to China, right? Or India?
India.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, hey, hon, it happens. Get mad like I did. That's when I got political. Oh, man, did I get really political. One thing that should hearten everybody no end. Last night around sometime in the early hours of the morning, Anonymous weighed in on a labor dispute issue.
Notice that, yeah.
They hit the Americans for Prosperity site, which is the Koch brother sponsored site, and proceeded to take it offline for over 12 hours. I sat here and laughed myself silly. I know I should not have done such a thing. It's not, you know, that is not considered to be kosher behavior.
No, no, but like, what was it, what was
Karma's
it?
Up.
Well, not just that, but I'm thinking movie reference night. I'm thinking of a line from Eleanor in The Lion in Winter, where she said, "And I'd, you know, Katharine Hepburn, of course, and I'd call it justice."
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And you know, it's, you know, they came out and they said, "Hey, you can't do this. We are now weighing in." Oh, man, talk about it. Last I heard, I checked the AFL-CIO's website, and they said that Governor Wanker is has ordered the windows welded shut.
That's a bit of extreme.
Yeah, so people can't pass food into the protesters.
Welding?
Uh-huh.
Who are they going to get to weld?
And if I know, I do know that the AFL-CIO is busily taking witness statements and legal depositions. Also, Darryl Governor Wanker has been hit with a unfair labor practices complaint. Blessings upon them.
Yes, indeed.
Now, I have a question for...
Well, I mean, have you seen a current status on what's going on there? Because the last I had was a couple of hours old.
They're still there. They're refusing to leave. The police are refusing to arrest them.
Well, that was the thing. That was the big thing over the weekend, was that the police just said, no.
Yeah, they were ordered to arrest. Well, it's basically the equivalent of Egypt. They were ordered to move in on them, and the police said, nah, not going to happen.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the Middle East and Egypt, I saw something in the chat room a moment ago, and I know you follow the news closer than I do. During the show, because, you know, I'm kind of busy here. But I saw something in the chat room to the effect that U.S. and Canadian forces are moving closer to Libya.
Yeah, they're making noises like there might be a military option. I really don't want to do that. But there's all that sweet crude, and there's all those...
Yeah, light. No, no, it's not just sweet crude, Susan. It's light sweet crude. Yummy, delicious on waffles.
Super powerful petroleum companies. Jesus bloody Christ. When are you guys going to learn? When? Okay, message to... oligarchs of the United States. This is for the people running the United States. I'm not talking to the president because he ain't running it. I'm talking to the companies that are running this country. You have a choice. You can have the Egyptian model or you can have the Libyan model. Your choice. But you will have change. It will come.
You know, there's I want to be optimistic along those lines, Susan.
I'm not optimistic. I'm just pissed.
Well, I understand that too, but there's something out there. I got this in an email from Sandra earlier today, and it kind of gave me a moment of pause, to say the least. It was outright disturbing. Don't know if you saw this. The version I have comes times, and it's one of those. You know how we've talked about how we'd like for there to be a cabinet position in the Obama White House, the Secretary of Jesus Barack. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
Well, right. It's time for him to get back to work, or it's further proof that we need him. It's another one of those Jesus Barack moments. The New York Times reporting today, and the reason I mention this is it kind of goes against, it kind of runs against the grain of your argument that there will be change. I'm not disagreeing to be disagreeable, but let me just share a couple of paragraphs with you. Again, this is a story by Cheryl Gay Stahlberg and Kevin Sack in today's New York Times. Seeking to appease disgruntled governors. And there's some more of that journalism, you know, Susan. Which disgruntled governors? How about another modifier in there? Seeking to appease disgruntled right-wing, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, oatmeal-dribbling, house-helmet-wearing Republican governors. President Obama announced Monday that he supported amending... Sit down, Susan. That he supported amending the 2010 health care law to allow states to opt out of its most burdensome requirements 3 years earlier than currently permitted. In remarks to the National Governors Association, Mr. Obama said he backed legislation that would enable states to request federal permission to withdraw from the law's mandates in 2014 rather than in 2017, as long as they could prove that they could find other ways to cover as many people as the original law would and at the same cost.
Mm-hmm. I saw it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of that is a sort of it's a little rug over the hole in the floor. Because there's no way they can.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they do something really loopy like enact universal health care inside their own states or a public option. You know, we had a phone call from Matt Osborne last week. Alabama is proposing a public option just to keep teachers from joining the Alabama Education Association. So, you know, maybe this is more brinksmanship and gamesmanship on the part of Barack Obama, but just off the top, it looks a little on the weak side.
Yeah. Well, let's face it, President, not sure, has turned out to be rather weak.
A little bit.
How about a lot?
Yeah, okay, I'm trying to have some optimism here.
No, I wasn't going on anything that President... not sure was going to do. Let's face it. I'm taking the long view. Because if you look at history, can you think of anything more unlikely than what is going on in the Middle East right now? Those people have been oppressed for decades.
If not millennia.
Yeah. And all of a sudden they are saying, okay, enough, we've had it. Change comes. It will come. Now you can have the Egyptian model, which was fairly peaceful, or you can have the Libyan model, which is getting really bloody. But it will come. And it will come here. Because change, especially the democratic kind, they're finding out in the Middle East, is contagious. And we are seeing what it could be, and we're saying, hey, wait a minute. We're supposed to have that here. They can't shut down the communication links fast enough. And that's what it may take a while. It may take a long while. It may take years. But it will come. Now, the only question is, how do you want it? Bloody or not?
Well, and I think based on the comments of Tim Pawlenty and Mitch Daniels, they'd answer you straight up if they get the opportunity. And, you know, it was said last week, open fire on them. Use live ammunition.
Uh-huh. Just remember, if you go with a bloody routine... Just remember what happened to Saddam Hussein.
But not just that. We also have to remember that they went the bloody route in Egypt. You know, more than 1,000 people died. More than 1,000 people died. God knows what the body count is in Libya. People were massacred in the streets in Bahrain. But you know what? It didn't make a difference. The thing to remember is that if the right wing gets its way and gets to use live ammunition, it does not change the outcome. The most important part of that process is for people to understand on our side that the response to violence, the appropriate response to violence, the winning response to violence, is never more violence.
And never give up.
Exactly.
Change will come. Like I said, it's your choice. And, you know, I agree with Sandra. It may take a long time, but it's going to come. It will come. I don't know if I'll be alive to see it. I really hope I am. But if it gets to be the really bad way, those guys better hope they can get out of the country fast. People will be in a nasty mood, and there's guns in this country.
Yeah, see, the right wing just thinks that the guns are all in the hands of...
No, they're not.
Well, no, they're not. But again, we cannot resort to the use of them.
Yes, I realize it. On an uplifting note, Governor Wanker's strategy seems to be backfiring on all levels.
Yeah, that's another New York Times thing that I saw a few minutes ago. New York Times CBS News poll indicates that a majority of people in the country oppose weakening bargaining rights for public workers.
Mm-hmm. And then to top it all off, a group of people in Wisconsin who had been rather iffy about joining a union. Well, that was before Governor Wanker did his thing. I think the vote to go for a union was something like 80%. So now Governor Wanker is responsible for another union joining, for another union coming into creation in Wisconsin. Way to go.
You know, the other thing that I find hopeful, and I just got this in from our pal Patty out in North Dakota, the letter from Anonymous they mentioned earlier. This is a beautiful thing. It hit earlier. Dear citizens of the United States of America, it has come to our attention that the brothers David and Charles Koch, the billionaire owners of Koch Industries, have long attempted to usurp American democracy. Their actions to undermine the legitimate political process in Wisconsin are the final straw. Starting today, we fight back. Koch Industries and oligarchs like them have most recently started to manipulate the political agenda in Wisconsin. Governor Walker's union-busting budget plan contains a clause that went nearly unnoticed. This clause would allow the sale of publicly owned utility plants in Wisconsin to private parties, specifically Koch Industries, at any price, no matter how low, without a public bidding process. The Kochs have helped to fuel the unrest in Wisconsin and the drive behind the bill to eliminate the collective bargaining power of unions in a bid to gain a monopoly over the state's power supplies. The Koch brothers have made a science of fabricating grassroots organizations and advertising campaigns to support them in an attempt to sway voters based on their falsehoods. Americans for Prosperity, Club for Growth, and Citizens United are just a few of these organizations. In a world where corporate money has become the lifeblood of political influence, the labor unions are one of the few ways citizens have to fight against corporate greed. Anonymous cannot ignore the plight of the citizen workers of Wisconsin or the opportunity to fight for the people in America's broken political system. For these reasons, we feel that the Koch brothers threaten the United States democratic system and, by extension, all freedom-loving individuals everywhere. As such, we have no choice but to spread the word of the Koch brothers' political manipulation, their single-minded intent, and the insidious truth of their actions in Wisconsin for all to witness. Anonymous hears the voice of the downtrodden American people, whose rights and liberties are being systematically removed one by one, even when their own government refuses to listen, or worse, is complicit in these attacks. We are actively seeking vulnerabilities. But in the meantime, we are calling for all supporters of true democracy and freedom of the people to boycott all Koch Industries paper products. We welcome unions across the globe to join us in this boycott to show that you will not allow big business to dictate your freedom. And here's the list of brands.
Anything made by Georgia-Pacific.
Right. If you see the Georgia-Pacific label on a paper product, put it down as though you had just picked up a poisonous snake. We're talking about Vanity Fair. Quilted
better
Northern.
Better yet, go to the store and say, here is a product I am not buying, and here is why.
Well, yeah, mention it along the way. Tell management. But the products are Vanity Fair, Quilted Northern, Angel Soft, Sparkle, Brawny, Mardi Gras, and Dixie. I noticed Charmin is not on there. Yay. And there's a list of European products. Demac Up, Kitten Soft, Lotus Soft, Tenderly, Nouvelle Soft, OK Kitchen Towels, Colhogar, Delica, Inversoft, and Tutto. But any way you look at it, if you see the Georgia-Pacific label, you know that by purchasing it, you are helping the Koch brothers. So, by all means, I checked. We don't have any of those products in our home, and we will not.
I don't have anything by them either, and it just tickles me to death.
You know, one of these days, I'm going to have, and we'll do it at the same time that maybe we're putting up the wind turbines and the solar panels. I'm going to have one of those wonderful Japanese toilets that does not involve paper and just, you know, a little warm blast of air or jets of water or whatever, and that'll be nice.
Yeah. Hey, I wish to mention something that did not get a bit of airplay, and it should have. Saturday was the day when everybody, all states were supposed to have rallies to support the people in Wisconsin. Well, you had a whole bunch of people show up in West Virginia, which is not exactly what I would call a blue state.
No, it was pretty good. So I didn't get to go down there.
Little Gold Plat for West Virginia.
Yep, and at least 200 people.
How about a great big hand of applause for the 300 people who showed up in Mississippi?
Great big. Matt Osborne, as I mentioned on the show Friday night, Matt Osborne covered it in Tennessee, and I haven't seen the report yet.
That's the most conservative state in the union, and they had them out in Mississippi. They had them out in Idaho. All over the country. I don't care how conservative. The giant is waking up. Yay. About time. Now, stay awake and go to the polls.
There you go.
Because that is where you blew it the last time. You didn't vote. Now, a lot of this is Republican problems, but you Democrats, you union Democrats, you non-union Democrats, I don't care what kind, you didn't get off your tushes and go to the polls, and that's on you. If you didn't vote, you ought to be ashamed. I voted because I learned real early. You may not have anything you could vote for, but there is always something you can vote against.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Susan, have yourself a wonderful evening, and I think we've got things off to a roaring start, and we will talk soon.
If people want a real giggle, check out today's show post, because there is a sign from the Wisconsin protests. We'll crack you up.
Oh, I saw it. You're talking about
Imperial Walker.
Oh, okay. No, I just got one, and I wasn't sure where it came from. I just got a photo from Betsy, and I'm not sure whether it was Wisconsin or elsewhere, but it's someone holding up a sign that says corporate access only. This is obviously near a Capitol building. Corporate access only. All others shall be taken in the rear.
The one on the show post, it says, "Time to stop the Imperial Walker," and it's got a picture of a Imperial Walker, as in from Star Wars.
Right.
I've got another one I'm going to be using at another time. It's just letters. It says, "Governor Walker, America on line one." I like that one.
And Ron and Raleigh also writing in, Susan, saying there was a rally in Raleigh. Wow, I got through that without hurting myself. There was a rally in Raleigh as well. He said, yes, here behind the pulled pork barbecue curtain. So have a good night, Susan. You take care.
Give my love to everybody. Thank
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye now. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Yes.
Andy.
Hey, Andy, what's up?
Redwood City.
Amen.
What's up? Oh, man. so many things. I was down in San Francisco on Saturday. We had a nice size rally there for the folks in Wisconsin.
Oh, you got out? Awesome.
The word got out, evidently. I had my Badger shirt on because I am actually a graduate from the U of W.
Oh, you're a noble alum of
Yeah, I spent some time in Madison.
Yeah, Bucky.
Bucky the Badger. And yeah. I had a Bucky the Badger shirt on, which I got some comments about. My fighting Bucky the Badger. But we had a nice turnout. I mean, there must have been a few thousand there.
No kidding.
The crowd stretched back pretty far.
God bless San Francisco.
So that was nice.
What was the mood of the crowd?
They were pretty fired up. People were, just basically saying, this is where you take a stand. People were so proud of people from Wisconsin. I mean, no doubt about it. This is a stand. This is so regressive. As you and many of your callers have said, this is such a step backwards. We're just going back. We can't. You got to stem the tide. And these guys look like they're the vanguard of stemming that tide of reactionaryism. So people were fired up, ready to rock and roll.
Speakers, I mean, music, what?
Yeah, there was a lot of union speakers. All the unions in the local area were represented, the teachers' unions, the iron workers, the longshoremen, people that are big in San Francisco and Oakland. I think the firefighters were there. Yeah, you know, who's who in the union community was down there. There were some politicians there, too, that were introduced as well.
Really? They actually came out and stood and got counted?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, involved with the city government.
Excellent.
So this is a city. It's the reason I live here and I moved back here from the East Coast is, you know, other than living in Europe, I can't see where else you live in the United States if you want to actually see Green Party members get elected to office.
I think that's a...
There's no place else.
No, that's a really, really valid observation.
No place else in this country. In Europe, communists get elected, you know, socialists get elected on a regular basis. A Green Party is a force to be reckoned with in some place, but not here. I mean, here they've killed it. You know, that goes back to the corporate media.
Well, and to be fair, Andy, and I'm not gooning on anybody. I'm really not. To be fair, it's that same old the cussed thing that besets us, and that is that because of the way election laws are written, third parties in states that don't have New York has that third party co-opting law, and I don't know what the formal term for it is, but it allows a third party to nominate somebody from another party to run on their ticket. But
right,
then
the Workers' Party, I think the one there,
New York Working Families Party, I think is what
right.
It's called.
And they end up endorsing usually a Democrat.
Yeah, but at least they can get some legs under them and run other candidates if they so choose.
Mm-hmm.
But what you see, for instance, here in West Virginia, and it frustrates me to no end, is there is always, and I hate to use this term, but I know no other to use, there is always a vanity candidate running from the Mountain Party for governor or senator or member of Congress. Now, I've been voting in this county in excess of 10 years now, and I have never seen a Mountain Party candidate on my ballot in anything except those positions.
So they never get a good start at the grassroots to really get something going?
No.
That's always seems to be a problem. Ralph Nader, of course, with the Green Party, that's a big problem he always had.
Someday, somebody, if they're really serious about this, someday someone is simply going, within the third party structure, somebody's got to run for city council. Somebody's got to start having candidates for county commission. Member of the, you know, just a plain old vanilla member of the legislature.
Right.
Because those constituencies are much smaller, and it's much easier and less expensive to campaign in them. But I never see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's damned frustrating.
Right, I agree. It's very difficult. I mean, here it's split, too. The Greens are split. There's a Peace and Freedom Party in California, which sucks up a lot of votes as well. And the Green Party, they kind of a spin off of there. And it is very difficult. And very difficult to get good candidates, too, because a lot of those candidates, quite frankly, a lot of people are way out there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an uphill struggle. But like Susan says, I think that there is hope that someday, and again, I know we've talked about this, we disagree on this. I don't think it's going to take too much to pop. I mean, someday something's going to pop where the people just get it, and it's going to happen real fast. And I don't think the elite and the oligarchists that run this country are going to know what hits them when it hits them. I think it's going to be a big surprise for them. But anyway. You know, one thing I tried to call last week, but your phone lines were pretty busy. I couldn't get through. I think I dropped the line at one point. But I didn't hear anybody talking about the UN vote that went on and how the U.S. and Israel were the only ones.
Yeah, I made mention of it. It was pretty disgusting. I think that was in the course of a conversation with Sandra, but yeah.
Right, condemning Israel for building an occupied territory. And there were 100 co-sponsors to that in the General Assembly, and I guess in the Security Council, it was 14-1, and of course the U.S. was the one.
Right.
And 100 co-sponsors, I think 133 nations overall in the General Assembly voted for condemning Israel. I mean, what, you know, I called all my representatives, senators, and House member. And I just go, is this ever going to stop? When are you ever going to represent the world and stand up for human rights and doing the right thing as far as international law goes and stop supporting that, that theocracy in the Middle East that doesn't believe in human rights, that only believes in stealing land from other people, that is totally racist against all its neighbors. I mean, when does this end? Does it ever end?
You know what?
I hate to be an American. I don't want to be. I feel like my representatives are so far out there and so corrupt and so without any compassion at all that it really galls me to death to know that I'm represented by this slime in Congress and in the Senate. You know what?
And well, I personally, and this is semantic hair splitting, that's the thing, Andy. You're not represented by them.
You're right.
You know,
we go back to Susan again, when it wouldn't bother me at all to see things really get out of hand here, because I'm tired of not being represented. I'm tired of this corruption and a government that totally is bereft of any kind of human rights or values of its citizens at all. And just run by a small group, an oligarchic group, and then a Zionist group called AIPAC, which does anything it friggin' wants.
Well, I've got a story. If that's already got your blood boiling, Andy, I got another one for you. You know, the Academy Awards were last night.
Right.
And the Oscar for Best Documentary Short Subject went to a little film called Strangers No More. And what it is it's a documentary about a school in South Tel Aviv. And this school in South Tel Aviv educates children that come from 48 different countries. And many of these children, their parents have come to Israel as either refugees or because their parents have immigrated for employment purposes. In her acceptance speech, just bear with me because there will be screaming shortly. In her acceptance speech, co-director Karen Goodman said the following. Thank you most of all to the exceptional immigrant and refugee children from 48 countries at Tel Aviv's remarkable Bialik Rogozin School. You've shown us that through education, understanding, and tolerance, peace really is possible. That was last night. This is today. Guess what, Andy?
People jumped down her throat or what? No.
It's much worse
Israeli
than that.
Community.
No, it's much worse than that. The Israeli government is going to take it out on the children. And what I mean by that...
Federal funding or...
No. For instance, one of the stars, so to speak, of the school, I mean of the film, is a 10-year-old named Esther. And she and 120 other pupils from that school are now, as a result of Israeli government decisions, due to be deported.
Oh, my gosh.
Just a week after the Israeli media ran its hip, hip, hooray reports of the win, the Oz unit will start rounding such kids up. And one of the children is the 10-year-old star of the film.
What is the Oz unit?
It's a group inside the Israeli Israeli government.
You know, a real problem with Israel is studies that people have done is, you know, the homogenization because of the theocracy that they have there is it's a very, very racist place. And you would think the best thing they could do to fight racism within Israel, that they don't respect their fellow man of different nationality, is to bring in people.
Well, absolutely.
Have them meet people from other cultures and other races, so they have respect for them.
Exactly.
But right now, they do not have respect for their neighbors, not at all.
And yet, frustratingly,
zilch.
You will see next to zero coverage of this, I predict, in the for-profit media in the United States. And anyone who dares speak up will immediately be shouted down. If they are Jewish, they will be called a self-hating Jew. And if they are non-Jewish, they will be called an anti-Semite. Because that's that's the way this whole thing works out. But in Israel, at least, there is a party there called Meretz. And the leader of the Meretz party is Chaim Oran. And he made no bones about it. He said the deportation plan, and it's not just 120 kids, it's 400 children.
Wow.
From this school. That will be deported. And Chaim Oran said the deportation plan is brutal, random, and regretful. Another former member of the Knesset from the same Meretz party said the deportation plan is nothing short of despicable and evil.
So Meretz is more of a left-leaning party.
It would appear, yeah. It's left. Yeah.
Compared to the Likud, which is the...
So right-wing it'd make Mussolini blush.
I consider it center-right because I believe there are parties even further to the right than Likud there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are right-wing parties in Israel that think that Likud is a bunch of flaming-haired liberals.
Right. But, man, they do have a problem. And they're
thinking, well, my God, you're going to take it out on 10-year-olds?
Right. And, two, they say as well that, you know, we think our psyops is at a high level here, and of course it is, no doubt. But in Israel, it's a quantum leap from the psyops that we're exposed to.
Oh, without a doubt.
They have a tremendous psyops regime that weighs in on the Israeli populace, especially when it comes, you know, to things like the ships that they tried to bring in into Gaza and so forth. The propaganda that they get spun from that, they do not, you know. I know there are some liberal-leaning newspapers, and is it Haaretz or
Haaretz? Yeah.
Haaretz, I think, is the most liberal-leaning. But overall, the amount of propaganda that they get spun with is beyond compare. It's all psyops against them. It's a shame.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, get off the subject. You were mentioning the group that's going after the Koch brothers.
Anonymous, yeah.
Anonymous, the WikiLeaks people. I just the great service that the WikiLeaks folks have done to this world, to me, is just can't be even counted. I just want to mention, there was another article I saw talking about Berlusconi that came out, and some WikiLeaks cables were intercepted from the ambassador to Italy, the U.S. ambassador to Italy, and it was quoted in the this article. It was either the New York Times or the Financial Times. I've read it. But in that article, it was done years ago when Berlusconi first came into power. But they were, the ambassador basically said, this guy is a total buffoon, Berlusconi. And if we work with him and we respect him and we put, because the other European leaders saw him as a complete looney tune and buffoon, if we work with him, he'll do stuff for us. And lo and behold, do you know that we have more American troops in Italy than any time in history, even after World War II? And during the Cold War?
I had no idea.
Yeah. Berlusconi allows us to base more troops there than have ever been there in the history, you know, post-war history. And you know that African group that they wanted to build up to kind of be a NATO of Africa to go in and swoop in and do intelligence work and to be able to
right.
do a quick... That's all based in Italy, because Berlusconi let them set that up there. So... Because they befriended Berlusconi and have a good relationship with the U.S. military, they've been able to grow their bases to, you know, enormous. I forget what the troop count is there, but it's something in, you know, a couple hundred thousand range that Italy, you know, bivouacs for the U.S. military. It's like a little, you know, safe haven for the military, where the other European countries basically are, you know, hands off. We basically had enough of U.S. imperialism and militarism. Italy is like, bring them in. Bring them in. The WikiLeaks said, you know, that, you know, if we befriend this guy, because the European nations aren't going to befriend him and aren't going to help him out, but if we do, he'll do anything we want. And basically he does. He lets the American military run roughshod over Italy. And if you remember a few years ago, too, they had that thing where the Apache helicopters were jerking around in some ski resort and they got caught in the wires and killed a bunch of people that were on because they cut the wires on the ski lift. Now, there's a reason that that's happening, because the U.S. has so many planes there and helicopters running around that nation. Anyway, another, you know, plus for WikiLeaks and the Anonymous group.
Well, they're doing good work, and, you know,
they're doing unbelievably great work, the stuff that filters out of there. Almost everywhere in the world you see something happening. There's some comment about WikiLeaks there.
Indeed, and you know, I just got a note from Ben Birch, telling me that apparently he said, speaking of hackers, he said Democratic Underground got hacked today, down for hours.
Well, you get hacked enough yourself.
Well,
you
mean,
the phone's just going down now. I wonder about.
No, that you don't have to wonder about. that's me not being able to afford a new uninterruptible power supply. We got equipment dropping like flies around here,
mm-hmm.
but no, I've got to crawl under the desk and do some repatching, and maybe buy a little bit longer power cord, and I should be able to solve that problem.
Right.
No, that was a big nasty bolt of lightning coming down, and you know that's just another one of those moments. It's February the 28th, right, Andy? What I'm looking at outside should be snow, not rain.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, one of my little pet theories is that climate change doesn't necessarily mean, and of course, you know, the right wing just, doesn't exist, it's not real, you're on drugs, you know. Climate change doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to snow in July or be blazing hot in January. It's just a gradual shifting of the seasons, and we see it. Year after year after year, you can see it.
Absolutely, especially in the wildlife in the East Coast. My mother was constantly saying, and I've seen it, you see birds there you never saw before.
I heard, before we left for the cruise, I heard a robin singing outside my bedroom window, and it was freezing cold.
Mm.
Okay? I was in Charleston yesterday, and driving home, I heard what we call around here in the hills, peepers. And one of the, and the two first signs of spring in the Appalachian Hills are the sprouting of ramps and the awakening of the peepers. And they're just little tiny tree frogs. But they make this beautiful song in the early evening. And I was hearing it all over the place last night because it was toasty warm. It was springtime warm. And I was like, oh, the poor little guys are going to get frozen to death. So, you know, the weirdness continues apace. You know, while a certain group of people just have their heads up their butts.
Right, it's doing what the scientists said it would do. It's because when it's warmer overall, you're going to get more precipitation because the air can hold more, so it's going to be wetter. You're going to have more floods, which we've definitely had. You're going to have more rain, and you're going to have more snow. And that's what's been happening. And you're going to have changes, you know, in the air current, and you're going to have changes in water current. And particularly in Europe, I know they are feeling it in a big way because they've never seen the snows that they've had and the type of changes like you saw in Russia with the fires last year and wind storms. I mean, it's been pretty amazing. It's just the extremes. You're hitting a lot more extremes, and the extremes are, or even though you're having some cold extreme lows, you're having more extreme highs in frequency, and that is a fact. Anyway, too, you mentioned John Stewart. You're talking about him just real quick.
Yeah.
I remember when he did that Rachel Maddow interview, one thing that really bugged me was how he didn't even get dressed up for that interview. Do you remember he came like
Yeah. He was in tennis shoes and said he was
from outside.
Yeah, he said he felt like crap. And
right. He showed her total disrespect. You know, not even being prepared for the interview or getting dressed up at all. It looked like he just, you know, walked in from reading the newspaper on a Saturday morning or something like that after getting up late from bed. I mean, it was really, I thought, very poor on his part. And I'm no fan of John Stewart anymore. I mean, I've had it with him. I mean, he's out of my list of any. I'm done with him, completely done. Now, one other thing, too, you mentioned, Woodson, who was with the Packers?
Yeah, Charles Woodson.
Came at. Charles Woodson, the defensive back, cornerback, or something like that?
Yeah, he's a D-back. I think he's a corner.
Great for him to come out and make a statement. That took guts for somebody, even though I know the Packers are a different entity as far as
the Jerry Joneses of the world ought to sweat a little bit because, they've got a law in the rule inside the NFL that says, and it's basically the no more Green Bay's rule. That right. There cannot be any publicly owned NFL franchises outside of Green Bay.
And that, of course, is the best way as far as...
Dave Zirin has...
citizenry goes to run a football team. They should not be like...
Dave Zirin has said that it should be challenged in court, and I tend to agree.
Absolutely.
Because that's just classic antitrust behavior, isn't it?
Right. You know, if we only had Obama with the same guts that Charles Woodson has, if Obama would actually walk with the people of Madison. Where is he?
He's out talking to right-wing governors.
Right, he talks a good game, boy, but he can't be out there. Another thing, too, I want to mention about Obama, which was in the news big last week, which I think you might have commented on somewhat, but, you know, the massive arms race going on to get money because he's going to need to raise $1 billion. And that, again, goes along with him visiting with all these executives and CEOs and just clowning around and having a good old time with the folks from Silicon Valley or the Jeff Immelt from GE and the people on Wall Street. God, it's just disgusting to see what, you know, how he just grovels to these people. He just seems to me he has absolutely... no empathy for the working class and working people of this country. Everything is just groveling to the rich so he can get his $1 billion so he can run again. And he's the one who created that arms race by not taking public funds.
But that's also what happens, Andy, as a function of, and I've mentioned this a couple of times, if I think the smartest thing the United States could do would be to repeal the term limits on the presidency. Because that's what compels presidents to behave like presidents behave. You know, we'd like for, we would like, for instance, for Obama to behave a little bit more like the FDR. Well, FDR didn't have a two-term limit hanging over his head. So FDR was politically free to do the right thing. But because you've only got one shot and it's 8 years or four, it compels presidents to behave in a sort of pusillanimous fashion, doesn't it? I mean, isn't that at least part of the problem?
You know, I would tend to agree with you that one thing, it's different now than it was when Roosevelt was around. And mainly I think about the electronic voting machines and the non-confidence I have in the voting systems to steal elections. And we've seen that when elections are stolen, which I have no doubt in my mind that George Bush stole the election in 2000 and in 2004, and this country will do nothing about it. It will do nothing about it, even though elections were stolen. There is no way in hell George Bush won in either 2000 or 2004. It did not happen. But he was put there anyway by the oligarchy of running this country. And I just do not have any faith in the electorate to rise up when elections are stolen. And with the electronic voting machines all over this damn country. And I even wonder about this guy Walker, Scott Walker, in Wisconsin. Was he truly elected? Because he supposedly only won by like 80,000 votes. And they use electronic voting machines there.
Right.
You don't know what the heck happened. You have no clue. Nothing. Nada. That's not an election. Electronic voting machine isn't an election. And I remember in New Jersey when I had to vote there, and I kept on going. They always showed me the electronic, and I kept on saying, no. No. This is ridiculous. I might as well not even vote if it's an electronic machine. This is absurd. I'm not voting on this garbage.
Yeah.
I have no clue that my vote will be counted. I have no idea my vote will ever be counted on this. You can do anything you want without anybody knowing the difference. You know, it's a joke. The whole electoral process in this country when you're using electronic voting machines is a joke.
Well, you know, it's like the Brad Friedman says over and over and over again. If you cannot ascertain the intent of the voter, a vote has not been cast.
Right.
How hard is that?
You know, and Brad, I know, has a computer science background himself. He was a programmer. I, as well, in another life, used to be a programmer. You can do anything you want with computers. You can do anything inside those machines without anybody knowing the difference.
Right.
It is amazing how vulnerable those machines. I don't know. I don't understand why people don't get that.
There's none so blind as those who cannot see. Can we start with that?
Yeah, it's just incredible. Hey, just a real aside. I pulled this out of a Financial Times. Just the last thing I want to talk about. The 225. You're talking about Obama again and running around with the CEOs. He was visiting, I guess, last week. I pulled this out in the Financial Times just last week on February 25th, and I think that was Friday. But he made this comment about we need more skilled labor in the U.S. Obama made that comment. And Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple, came back, and he goes, the biggest reason Apple had thousands of workers in China manufacturing products instead of in the U.S. was because of a shortage of mid-level engineers who were on the ground in the factory, making sure that operations are functioning effectively. Now, we have a 12.4% unemployment rate in California. You tell me there aren't mid-level engineers here that can do the job? And just like Susan was saying, no, there's one reason why Steve Jobs has 1,000 workers in China. I can't even believe they still spew out this swill, and we're supposed to swallow it. It's called money. Go to a totalitarian regime that won't even let its people listen to what's on the World Wide Web at all, and one demonstrator, you know, sticks his nose up in the middle of a square of Beijing, and 100 cops jump all over him. That's the type of totalitarian regime that is. There is no dissent permitted whatsoever. And these son of a bees in Silicon Valley have no problem hiring thousands of workers in China, and we're supposed to believe it's because they have better trained engineers there. It is an incredible thing. This is last week he said that. They don't get it. That's why I believe it, what Susan says, is when things start to really go nuts, these guys who run these companies, they don't get it. They are in such a bubble. They are so far above us. They're living in a different fantasy world, a totally different, where human rights, where pain people have, where people losing jobs, like our friend in Texas. This doesn't register to these people at all. They feel or see no pain whatsoever of what's happening, you know, in the reality world. It is an amazing thing. They just don't get it.
No, they don't, and it's a function of, well, we've asked the question time and time again, Andy. Is this what happens when you get in? I mean, do you willfully enter the bubble, or does having all of the bubble people around you just suck it out of you? I honestly don't know. Because there are a small handful of people who seem to manage not to get sucked in.
Right. I just wonder about Obama. Is, like you said, is he really? Does he really believe the stuff he's saying now? Or, I mean, who was pulling the strings of putting guys like Jeff Immelt? What an affront to have him on the subcommittee for labor, for creating jobs in America, from the company that started outsourcing under Jack Welch. I mean, what an affront to create jobs. This is the country that invented outsourcing, a GE. This is the country that got rid of, like, I don't know how many thousands of workers last year and closed, I don't know how many dozens of factories in the U.S. And you put him in heavy job creation? What, are you kidding me?
It did seem a little bit...
I mean, what an affront. What an affront to American workers to watch this. Watch this guy in action. I mean, it just boggles the mind.
Well, it does that, and... Well, it's like the story I mentioned earlier about, you know, Obama saying he's game for letting states bail out on the
health care law that he did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what?
Well, you know what Walker wants to do? Basically, they want to privatize the Medicare system and give vouchers for Medicaid
right.
at the state level. Geez, you know how many people are going to be dying then because they have no health care? Oh, God, it's going to be unbelievable. You think about bankruptcies and people destitute? That's just a plan for destitution. Unbelievable. And Obama's going to let them do that. And then, you know, another slap in the face to the citizenry is this guy, Walker, is put on the governor's committee for health care across. And he's going to be the head honcho of all the governors for the health care solutions for Medicaid.
Breathtaking, isn't it?
Jesus, unbelievable. Unbelievable. The Republican solution is basically what Grayson, it's just what Grayson said.
Die quickly.
Right. Don't get sick. If you do get sick, die quickly. Simple as that, man.
That's They're not kidding.
Just die. Did you hear, too, where they caught this congressman from New Jersey? I think his name is Lance, who's been against Obama's health care, and he turned down the government health care that he gets in at the federal level. And they tried to, he was saying that we had no, you know, our health care is the best in the world. We have no problems with our health care. And finally they figured out that he let go, that he doesn't need health care because he's covered for the rest of his life in the state of New Jersey because he was in the state house so long as a senator or assemblyman that he gets lifetime health care. Jeez.
Yeah, well, and
they caught this guy. Unreal. There's a state for you with this
I don't know what to call this guy Christie, which galls me to the high heaven, you know, running around just using the state workers as a scapegoat. And here, if you're a representative in New Jersey, you get lifetime health care. Beautiful.
What a racket.
Right? And you got to attack the state workers who are making, you know, an average less than four. My brother is a state worker in New Jersey. He's a county worker, right? He's worked 15 years. He doesn't even make $40,000 a year. Doesn't even make $40,000. And his pension, you know, what he expects to get, they tell him he's got to work till he's 67. He's like 50 now, and he can hardly bend over because his back is so bad because of the heavy work he's got to do. And he's got to work till he's 67. He goes, he'll be lucky if he can work five more years at the pace he's going. Unbelievable.
It is. It is.
Well, you'll be lucky maybe if you get to $30,000 a year or $20,000 a year pension.
Well, and then look, you know, they're sweating.
$20,000.
You know, Walker in Wisconsin's going nuts over pension. Well, they're fully funded or within a few. And, you know, you're the guy who knows more about this than I do. But you know how a pension plan would be rated if it was funded in excess of 95%. That would be a solid gold pension plan, wouldn't it, Andy?
Well, they call it with the projected benefit obligation. And if the assets are 95%, it's pretty darn good, because it's still, if it was 100%, it would be fully funded.
Right.
If the assets reach the projected benefits that are necessary going forward.
But I mean, Wisconsin is funded in excess of 90.
The pension's not in trouble.
Yeah. And the thing is, the pensions themselves are modest in the extreme. I mean, we're talking about pensions that after retirement, you know, maybe it's $25,000, $26,000, $27,000.
Like at CalPERS, I know, I actually used to work for the pension fund at CalPERS. 78% of the beneficiaries are receiving under $36,000 a year. 78% of the beneficiaries. And I tell you,
and yet the Republican Party is offended, Andy. The Republican Party is offended that those pensions exist.
Right. They don't want, the bottom line is,
because,
they want it all, and they do not want anybody to have a defined benefit pension plan anymore.
Right, because those defined benefit pension plans are guaranteed money, and it's money that the money changers in the temple aren't getting to play with on Wall Street, right?
Absolutely. It's managed by professionals and by the state. You have professional portfolio managers and investment officers that are managing the money. So when you have those kind of economies of scale, when you have billions, like I don't know how much, at CalPERS they had like $165 billion to manage. When you have that kind of money, you tell Wall Street where to go. I mean, you buy in huge economies of scale. Instead of buying, let's say, a REIT, a real estate investment trust on Wall Street, you go buy a building in Hong Kong. Or you go buy a building in Berlin as your real, part of your real estate investment.
Right.
You skip the middleman. You skip this Wall Street baloney. You know, and if you're going to do investments, again, you don't have to use Wall Street either. You can invest directly into some companies with private equity and skip Wall Street and go direct. Skip the middleman. Wall Street doesn't like that. You know, they don't like big pension funds bullying them around. And when these guys go in and you maybe a bond offering comes out and some big pension funds says, I'll buy $50 million, what kind of, haircut are you going to give, and I'll buy $50 million worth of these bonds? Oh, they don't like that, because they like the retail guy that's only going to buy.
Right, yeah, know, yeah, that old mantra obtains on Wall Street. It's kind of the reverse. Never pay wholesale.
Right, but the pension funds can buy wholesale because they'll buy in bulk. And they will, be on the negotiate. They will be on the, what would you call it? They have the negotiating edge. I mean, they can go toe to toe with Wall Street. And of course, Wall Street hates that. They want to divide and conquer, break it up into all these little retail investors, and we'll just friggin' destroy them with fees. And they can't do anything about it. Whereas a big pension fund can go around Wall Street, and they can go right to Europe or go right to Asia, and go directly into their markets and buy sovereign debt with their government bonds. As a retail investor, you can't do that here.
you know, there's so many things. Mainly, you don't have enough money to do that. But a big pension fund, U.S. state pension funds, can do that. They can do the things that a small investor can't. And Wall Street hates that, Bob. They hate it. They hate it. That's
right. That's why they want it.
They want it all. They want to just destroy every state pension fund, period.
And by destroying it, we mean take the money into their greasy little mitts and play with it themselves. And
absolutely.
You know what? If the pensioners lose their shirt, well, you know, tough luck.
Tough
you shouldn't
luck.
Have been in the market.
Right.
But they had no choice.
Absolutely, because you're so limited to what you can invest in. But these big pension funds, again, like I said, they have much, much more leverage and flexibility. And they have professional managers who are actually watching it every second. And are responsible, again, for making sure that they can cover the liabilities that are being accrued. And you're just much better off. And you know, who the heck has the time to manage your own investments anyway when you're working full time? Come on. Even professional managers have a tough enough time making money. Let alone somebody who's working full time and doing something else totally to be able to spend all their time trying to manage their 401k. It's total baloney. There's just, you know, Bob, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind when a lot of the baby boomers come time to retire and the money isn't there, there's going to be a huge crisis in this country, just like there was during the Great Depression. A huge crisis because so many people who are retiring just aren't going to have the money. The 401k plans they're going to find was a total failure. And mainly it's because Wall Street ate them up by fees. You know, they just ate them up. They just ate up those 401k plans because of the fees that Wall Street charges. And they love that. They want everybody to be in a 401k because they can just eat you alive when it comes to the fees.
There you go.
When it comes to the limitations in the investments that you have because you're so limited.
And that's
oh, well.
Right, and it's limited the way that your choices are limited on the Carnival Midway.
Right, it's like you have to invest domestically.
Or playing blackjack in Vegas. You know, they do it. Yeah, because if you play blackjack, as I've mentioned, you know, that's as close as you can get to even odds in a Vegas game. And yet, and so Vegas keeps manipulating it, whether it's all cards or face up or, you know, one whole card or with how many decks the dealer is dealing out, the dealer's dealing out of. Wall Street's no different. Is it? Because
no, it's a gamble, man. It's all a gamble. And if you're going to be in there gambling, you better be watching it every second, which most people just don't have the time to do.
Exactly.
But when you're into mutual funds and ETF, exchange-traded funds, and all the stuff that give you a little more security, even that, man, you still got to keep on top of it.
Oh, and speaking of corporate crooks,
do it.
I did pull up the story here. A Massey Energy. He was the chief of security at Upper Big Branch. Huey Elbert Stover has been indicted for lying to the FBI and obstructing justice. Of course, he's the schmuck who's going down. They haven't touched Don Blankenship, nor will they.
It sounds like a Lindy England sort of deal. Go after the low-level people instead of going after Rumsfeld and Bush and people like Colin Powell for all the Abu Ghraib.
Because I guess they're charging this guy of shredding some documents, getting rid of documents. I love this paragraph, Andy. Shane Harvey, general counsel for Massey Energy, said the company notified the Justice Department within hours of learning that documents wanted by investigators had been disposed of and took steps to recover the papers and turn them over to the government. Within hours.
That's pretty
loud. Hey, did you replace that shredder that burned up? Good. Is the new one's working? Still shredding? Good. Okay, we'll call the government now. We tried to get them for you. It was just a big bag of shredded paper.
Right.
Now, why would this guy just take it upon himself? He has to know it was illegal. Why would he just take it upon himself to do that? Well, the short answer is he didn't.
Right. Now, you're giving the ultimatum. Get shredding. Get those shredders going.
Yeah. Fall on your, you know, because this is Omerta. You know, you don't have to be in the mob for Omerta to apply.
Right.
You fall on your sword. We'll take care of you. You'll go do your time. You keep your mouth shut. You'll be okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, corporate America knows. Enron scandal showed that, too, that you get rid of the guy. Same thing with the
guy. Well, I mean, look at the dolphin die-off on the Gulf, Andy. Have you been reading about that? This stunning number of this is calving season for dolphins down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, the ones they're finding on the beach.
And little baby dolphins are washing up on the beaches all the way from Florida to Louisiana.
Right, like 10 times the normal death rate, something like that. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I listened to the Dar Jamal piece that you had, and that was amazing to me. Was the lawyer who's supposed to be, you know, representing all the plaintiffs?
Yeah, he's in on the dodge.
He's paid $850,000 a month from BP.
Yeah, well, yeah, the some obscene number per year. It's like $85,000 a month or something. Yeah, or I don't know. Maybe it is
$850,000.
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe it was. Yeah,
a month.
Yeah, because the guy's making millions.
Right.
And he was. And the thing is, it's proof that anybody can be corrupted, Andy. Because this was the guy who did a fairly decent job previously.
Right, with the 911.
Yeah.
Fund.
But, you know, BP got to him and showed him which side the bread was buttered on, and I guess it was game on.
Right. What a conflict of interest. That's tremendous.
Just blows my mind.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot for the time. I know you got a lot of other
calls. Oh, God. It's always good to hear from you, Andy.
Got a lot of other stuff out there.
Yeah, we got a few stacked up, but we'll get to them. Good to hear from you, my friend.
All right, Bob, you take care of yourself. Thanks for the great work you did.
And, you know, thank you for getting out to the rally on Saturday. That's really cool. That's
March
a good 19th, example.
March 19th, Washington and the other major cities, that's the date, too. There'll be a big rally for working people. Mark that in your calendar.
Absolutely. Take care, Andy.
And Malloy is talking in Washington, a matter of fact.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
But we'll be here. We've got the 19th marked.
All right.
All right.
Later, Andy.
Good one.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I'd love to be there on March 19th in D.C. That would be worth the D.C. run. And moving onward? Or maybe not. Wow, where'd everybody go? Hey, welcome to the program.
I'm here. It's Richard.
Hey, Richard. What's up?
Well, I've been gone for a while. I thought I'd give you a call. Had a couple of issues in mind. I hope you had a really great trip.
Oh, it was wonderful. Even the seasick part was wonderful.
Well, talking about transportation, you know, your passenger train was Robert Byrd's pet project.
Yes. The Cardinal?
Yeah, and I'm worried you may lose it with your guy in Washington now.
Oh, the Blanche Mansion?
Yeah. Because, you know, the Cardinal came up on the chopping block every time Amtrak was pressured to, you know, save money someplace.
Right.
You know, and you only get three trains a week in each direction anyway, which is really unfortunate.
It really sort of defeats the utility of it.
It really does. Even one train a day on any route defeats the utility because it's only good for point-to-point travel from one end of the run to the other sort of thing. It's amazing people, you know, people patronize the trains in the middle of the night the way they do. And, you know, when I was a child, there were three through trains right near you on that route.
Well, I didn't know.
Yeah, you could get on in Washington three different times in the day, and get off in Charleston or Cincinnati or Ashland. They all went through Ashland. That's Kentucky, right?
Yeah, just across the river.
Yeah, there was a lot of combining and splitting of the train in the middle of the route at different points. You know, so you can do that with a passenger train. You can discombobulate. Send cars over here and over there. So it, Yeah, I used to take it from New York City, in fact.
Well, it's badly needed, and that's what makes the idiocy of like Rick Scott in Florida and Kasich in Ohio and Walker in Wisconsin. Oh, we can't afford to when the money's sitting there.
You're talking about high speed rail, right?
Yeah,
high speed. You know, I got a little story to tell you. May I?
No, please. This? Yes.
We have a ferry boat paper here in the Bay Area. It comes out once a month. And there's some weird stuff that gets into that paper. And one of them, a few years back, somebody did a fantastic piece about the recovery of the Dutch railroads after World War II. And it's a model that I've never seen described anywhere else. So this may be something that we can really use. What happened was when the Germans were retreating, they blew up everything they possibly could on the way out. And I've got photos that show, in Holland, they'd plant an explosion like every couple of yards along the Dutch railroad track. I mean, they just turned it into pretzels of steel, blew up the bridges. The first thing that the Dutch had to do after the war was restore some kind of passenger rail service and, of course, freight as well. And what they did was they decided to fix, like, one track of each pair because they're bidirectional, they're two tracks.
Right.
And so what they did was they restored what they had just minimally, and instead of trying to do a first-rate job of it, what they did was they have a grid of track in the country, and so what they did was they started up service where everything connected with everything else. So they weren't going for speed, but they were going for connections. So you could get from any point to any point else by just changing trains once or twice. And it was great. You know, it worked. So you could get wherever you wanted to go within a reasonable period of time. And what the Brits invented railroads in effect in about 1830. And because they were the inventors, they got some things wrong. Just like we were the first, aside from the Greeks, I guess, we were the first democracy in modern times. And we screwed up some things. And other countries have benefited because they came along later and said, oh, my God, the Americans screwed up here, they screwed up there. So the Brits made their trains too narrow. They're too skinny. And the trains can't come in from the continent except, through that high-speed tunnel that they have now. They can't get any further than London, and that's a dedicated route from the coast to London. And so what happened was the Brits wanted to make their trains run faster, so they didn't go for, like, what the Japanese did or the French did, like super, super high speed, but they developed trains that would run at a good increase in speed but do it over existing track. And so they've done very nicely with that. What do you think about that as an idea?
It's certainly a possibility. One of the things that we face here, wow, what did I just break? Hold on.
I don't know. It sounded good.
Yeah, that was an ugly thud. One of the things that we face here is that our passenger rail, the rails themselves have been destroyed by, you guessed it, coal trains.
Well, but they're built for that. I don't know if they're destroyed by it. I mean, the Chesapeake in Ohio, it's called CSX now. It was a very heavy-duty railroad. So, I mean, it was made, it was built to withstand that kind of, heavy freight traffic.
But not to the extent that the traffic is on it now.
Yeah. If I look at an aerial photo, I notice that tracks have been removed. So there's more, there's more wear on the tracks that are left.
Right. And, I learned this stuff firsthand.
Oh, yeah? How's the ride on the train?
It's awful. I mean, it's really, really, really bad.
Yeah, I believe it. Well, CSX is I don't like the company. I got to say that they've been amputating parts of themselves. You know, this super corporate mentality. They want quick bucks, very, you know, they want lots of bucks and they want them fast. And one way to do that is to get rid of what you think is not as efficient as something else. So they've destroyed parts of the old Seaboard Airline Railroad that was in competition with the Atlantic Coastline, which they own too. And this has happened in a number of locations. Or, you know, if you had a two-track main line, well, you take up one of the tracks. Now you're running trains in both directions on one track. And I think, am I making sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah, so the Illinois Central Railroad, which is one of our few, you know, direct north-south routes, was bought and sold and, you know, and patched up and, you know, just, you know, made into a pretzel different ways. So many times I can't keep track of it. The original company is now the Whitman's Chocolate Company, among other things. You know?
Jeez, what, huh?
Yeah. And the present owner is the Canadian National, which is no longer National. It's now CN because the Canadian government sold it off. It got privatized when nobody was looking. So it's a NAFTA railroad, really. You know, I mean, it goes from Canada to New Orleans. And so it's not much of a, you know, of a toss to get from New Orleans to Mexico. I look at this stuff.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah. And it matters down the road.
I think so. We have only four east-west companies in the United States now, trunk line companies. That is damn scary. Let's say if you're a worker, you know, if you're a railroad worker and you know, somehow get screwed up with your company, you know, let's say you get fired. You're never going to get hired by that behemoth that developed again. See, so, you know, for labor it stinks. There used to be something like 96, what I call first-class railroads in the U.S. Now I think there's like six. First class used to mean...
yeah, but that doesn't mean they disappeared. That means they got gobbled up.
They got gobbled up. Yeah. That's right. So, you know, to me, I guess, you know, high-speed rail would be really cool. But in the meantime, we could have, you know, we could at least restore a better semblance of what we had, let's say, in the 1950s, just on the track that we've got already. Although it would be nice if it were improved. As you said, it's a rough ride. So, wow, we got so much to do in this country.
And the thing we've got to understand, Richard, is we ain't going to get none of it done as long as the Republicans are where the Republicans are. They don't have to just be defeated. They have to experience a fundamental sea change. You know, I saw a quote earlier today, and it came from, let me see here, I can find it in a second. No, I'll be there in a minute. Oh, here it is. Former Utah Senator Bob Bennett, the guy that was thrown out by the teabaggers earlier, last year.
Uh-huh.
He gave an interview. And he gave the interview to, you know, Greta Van Susteren on Radio Rwanda. And Bennett is still pissed off about the fact that he was subjected to a teabagging purge. But he said something that's very real, and this is what I mean about a sea change to the very nature of the Republican Party. He said, and this is the quote, "And people talk about Ronald Reagan, but I remember Ronald Reagan very well. But Ronald Reagan would probably not recognize the description of Ronald Reagan that is coming out of a lot of the Tea Party blogs. Ronald Reagan, yes, he was very conservative. Yes, he was a man of principles, and he wouldn't budge on those principles. But he said some things that would be absolutely anathema to many of the Tea Party people when he said it's better to get 80% of what you want than zero. And Reagan would compromise. Reagan would make deals. Now, I, for one, would not pee on Ronald Reagan's grave if it was burning up. But there's an element of truth in it. There's an element of truth in what Bennett says. And that is that, you know, the right wing goes out and flogs old dead Ronnie. They do everything short of digging him up and carrying him around like the adherents did to Ayatollah Khomeini. But there's no logical or intellectual relationship between what teabaggers want and what Reagan did. Now, Reagan was a pig. He was a vicious, hateful, nasty, old, racist, bigot, dull, you know, I could go on and on.
Very hateful. Yeah.
Yeah. And hate just oozed out of his pores.
I recall him as being really intransigent, you know?
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like somebody asked me the other day, you know, how do we talk to Republicans about taxes and about the fact that it takes taxes to make this country work, Richard?
You know, I don't know, but I think framing is something that we have to do.
It absolutely is, and I made a suggestion along these lines.
Yeah, we got to
take one of these teabaggers. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to run over the top of you.
Yeah.
But take one of these teabaggers, any of them, when they engage you in conversation, let them go for a little bit, kind of like what Ron and Raleigh was putting up with earlier. And after a while, well, Ronald Reagan, he was a great president, wasn't he? And, of course, teabaggers, Republicans, you know, they'll stand up and start reciting the pledge at the mention of Ronald Reagan's name if they don't just openly weep. And when they do that, you say, well, why can't we go back to Ronald Reagan's tax rates?
I love it. But you see, I don't see teabaggers where I live, you know? We have some tea.
Lucky you.
Well, maybe not. I mean, the thing is, okay, I'm close to Berkeley, and when you live around here for a long time, you get stars in your eyes, and you begin to think that the whole country is like this, which it is not. You know, and this is not reality. And there's a lot of problems with Berkeley as well. But I'm laughing because, you know, there was an article in one of our local papers a while back that showed that there were teabaggers in these parts who were making a lot of noise. But when they got under the surface, it turned out that there were just a few of these people, but they were popping up in multiple places. You see?
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I was here. I came to California when Reagan was governor, and the man was a horror. I remember the mental, you know, he closed the mental hospitals in the state.
Yes.
Okay, and...
And he started a rage for that, and he went on and did it on a federal basis as well, under the guise of being humanitarian, when in fact you took desperately fragile people and just threw them out on the damn street.
Which is exactly what I saw in San Jose. I mean, I have a friend in San Jose. You know, we visit at times. And I remember, you know, I would go and see him. We'd go for a walk. And the dazed mental patients were just wandering all over the streets. They got moved into halfway houses, you know. And I think it cost more to pay off the private operators of these halfway houses than it did to run the mental hospitals. Of course, they had to dope up all the patients, you know, because they had no way to keep on top of them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so these people were in a daze all the time. And that, you know, got to thank Ronnie for that. I mean, Jesus, what a jerk. But, you know, getting back to our political parties, I'm more scared of the Democrats than I am of the Republicans, Bob.
Why? Because
there's no opposition from them. I mean, you know, it's like...
And because you can never tell when they're going to turn around and stab you in the back?
Well, sometimes, you know, sometimes there's that, too. Yeah. I mean, we have a paper in San Francisco called The Bay Guardian, and every once in a while they use the term Dianne Feinstein's backstab, you know? It's a running meme. In that paper, and granted, they're so left wing that they sometimes frighten me, you know, that they're so politically correct I can't read the paper. I'm getting old, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, and this paper is printed with soy ink that's gray on little tiny fonts that I can't read because it's so politically correct. I gave up. I can't read the damn paper anymore, you know? But, oh, God, with Jesus, St. Reagan. You know, I've written a book. That's one of the reasons I haven't called. I had to just lock myself up and finish the book, which I've self-published. And I was just down in the post office. I'm mailing these all around the world. And I was just down in the post office sending off three copies. And I said to the clerk, I need a stamp. So he gave me a Ronald Reagan stamp.
Ah.
You know, and I looked at that. I said, don't give me this crap. This guy was a jerk. No, take it back.
Don't you have an upside-down airplane or anything back there I can have instead?
Well, I don't know. But speaking, I got to say, I love Dr. Bill. Dr. Bill teaches history the way I teach music. And I'm a sucker for Dr. Bill.
Well, we're going to have more of these little chats that we've described. There'll be more of those coming along. And then, of course, the summer session will be just an absolute week of historical immersion with people who really, really know what they're talking about. So it's going to be big cool.
Well, I listen to Dr. Bill. I have to tell you, it's like being stoned. I mean, I'm fly. When I hear Dr. Bill, I'm in the ozone. This is like listening to, Terry Gross interview Studs Terkel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I am really flying. This guy is just awesome. And I certainly recommend to everybody who's listening, if you have not heard Dr. Bill, by God, you must hear this guy talk about history.
And the thing is, he makes it relatable to present circumstance.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Indeed. You know, I'm reading a magazine right now. Let me get my fingers on this thing. It's an old issue from 1932 of Locomotive Engineers Journal. 1933. This was the union magazine for locomotive drivers.
Oh, wow.
And I'm reading, 1933. This thing is thick. It's like, 70 pages a month they put out. It was a very respectable magazine, and I can't find a typo in it. We're talking professional production here. And I swear to you, it's deja vu, Bob. The same crap was going on.
Yeah.
Depression that we're going through now.
That's part of my ongoing thesis, that our failure lies in the failure of what I call the failure to transmit transgenerational wisdom. Is that too big a mouthful?
No. It's reality. It's true. And, our parents went through it. Your parents went through it, didn't they?
The Great Depression? Hell yes.
Yeah. But I think it's human nature. Well, first of all, it's human nature to discount what the previous generation tells us. We have to rebel. You know, I think that's built into us. We have to rediscover the wheel.
I understand some of that.
You got kids, you know.
But by the same token, there's, and my thesis on this is that transgenerational wisdom has largely been replaced by by electronic media. And I guess I'm guilty of this too, but I'm trying to do, and we in the Horn family are trying to do what we can to pass it around and do a little bit of replacement strategy for it. But where Granny and Grandpa used to tell you stories, well, now the TV does it. And they tell you about Kim Kardashian and the fact that she's not feuding with Paris Hilton anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do, but you know, I can look back on the history of your area, for instance, or let's get even to the south of you, let's say to the very southern part of your state. And I'm a musician, so I pay attention to the. I'm kind of unusual because I pay attention to changes in performance and what people are hearing and the little details about that, and. You know, when I was a kid, there wasn't that much radio in your hills, right?
it was hard to get.
Yeah, it sure as hell was hard to get. And because you got all those mountains that interfere with the signal. And, you know, people didn't have electronically amplified musical instruments. So, you know, they made do with what they had, or they even made their own instruments. There was, you know, such an incredible rich tradition of folk music in the Appalachian Mountains. And you have those haunting ballads. You know what I'm talking
about. Oh, yes.
You know? And, I mean, my God. I mean, I grew up with some of them in New York City, but, you know, it's a fraction of what the richness of the culture that your parents grew up with. And each generation, you know, moves forward and it supplants what came before. And each generation's, how would I put it, each generation has changes in music. So the dissonance of one generation becomes the consonance of the generation that follows.
And oh, that's profound.
You know, and I can track that, but other people can track that better than I do because I focus on different stuff. But you see, the radio and the record player killed your folk music, and rock music killed your folk music.
I don't know that I would necessarily say that. Because obviously, you know, if you look at the rise of Nashville, it was record producers going into the hills that brought, for instance, Mother Maybelle Carter out of the woods.
Right. But there's been a transformation, with electric instruments. It's changed the character of the music quite a bit. So, we continually progress. You know, I can go to any jazz club around here. I shouldn't say any. I mean, we have some jazz clubs. Oakland, California, when I joined the Musicians Union back in the 60s, I discovered that Oakland was a real center for jazz. I wouldn't have known that, you know, without reading it in the Musicians Union paper. And so if I go around and I listen to what people are doing in jazz clubs, we have amplified instruments that don't even need it. You know, so, like, I'm tripping out on what a saxophone player is doing. Well, I'm hearing him coming out of a loudspeaker now. You've got a microphone. He's playing in a small club, you know. So we have instruments that need the amplification that are amplified, and we have instruments that don't need the amplification that are amplified, and so we're listening at tremendously louder levels. And these are, like I said, these are things that I'm noticing. So the culture changes, you know, some of this is sort of intrinsic. It just happens and happens generation after generation. It changes. You know, it's like you started this in my mind when you said something about electronic, broadcasting, you know, over the air, TV especially. Is that correct?
Well, yeah.
It's working on people's minds, you know.
Yeah, now I'm watching the chat room as well, Richard, and, you know, you're getting a little pushback. Because, you know, Lottie just said electric instruments add another dimension to music. They don't defeat it.
Yes, he's right. Lottie is correct. Okay? That's true. But at the same time, some earlier aspects of the performance are diminished.
I mean, and another point
that's
being another point being made in the chat room, for instance, rap, hip hop, that sort of thing, and I've made this point as well. That's, you know, that's not a diminution of music. That is an expansion upon an old form. I mean,
that's true.
There's more
as anything else.
Rap and hip hop has more in common with the balladeering that comes out of Appalachia, or in fact the recited rhyme schemes of Homer done to a lyre. But there's a lot of racism and there's a lot of covert bigotry in this country. Well, them boys are wearing their pants too low and look at them driving fancy cars and bull. You know what I mean?
I do, and I'm going to be the first one to say that rap music is legitimate, you know. And as a matter of fact, it's a type, you know, it's a popularization of poetry.
Yeah.
But see what I'm saying?
I mean, anybody who's ever heard someone who is really gifted in ancient Greek, accompanied by, and I've had occasion to hear this, I can't speak a lick of it, but I can sit and listen, accompanied by the musical instruments of that time and the tonalities and everything, it's stories being told via verse and rhythm and music.
Right. No argument out of that from me. I've argued with other people, you know, in favor of these new forms. I mean, there's no argument to be had, really. It's just happening. But what I'm getting at, too, is that the music changes and old elements are lost. You know,
well, I think if I understand you correctly, Richard, you're describing what some scholars of learning describe when they talk about the transition in humanity away from memorized storytelling, for instance, the origins of Homer. There was no writing at the time. Homer's stories were first told. But what happens when the human mind is exposed to written language? Facilities of memory go away.
True. That's good. Those are good points. See, what I'm hearing is a diminution of lyricism and subtlety in a lot of what I hear. And by the way, I hear this happening sometimes in classical music as well. So, you know, for what it's worth.
I once had a disc of what was called Christmas music being performed on what sounded like cats being killed.
How was it?
And it was very medieval, and it was things like sackbuts and norblats and the musical instruments with which I was utterly unfamiliar. But it was very discordant and very annoying to my ear. And I'll tell you a story. We got a minute for a story?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I don't know anybody else.
Agnes and I were on the boat, and we were having a lovely evening to ourselves. The kids were off doing kid things, playing up in the kids zone, that kind of stuff, having fun. And so we were just wandering around the ship, enjoying ourselves. And this moment came when we walked by one of the bars, and there was a million different bars. There was a piano bar and a disco, and there was a sports bar at the casino. And this little bar happened to have a string quartet in it.
Where was this?
Aboard the ship.
Oh, on the ship.
Yeah. And we stopped and listened, and Agnes got this raptured look on her face. And I was sort of reaching with my ear, because while I can't play, you know, I can barely play a radio. But my ear is solid tin. But I can hear things when they don't, I hear what it sounds like when it doesn't sound right. My ear is almost pitch perfect for spoken word, but not worth a damn for music.
Yes. I could go on for an hour about that.
But, so we're listening. And I keep hearing what I think is a melody I recognize. And bless these young women's hearts, and they were young women, and they were just, and it was a string quartet, and there was two violins, a viola, and a cello.
Right.
And they were all just sitting there sawing away. And I looked at Agnes and just kind of whispered, and I got punched in the ribs for my efforts. I said, "Is this Waiting for the Bus in F sharp minor diminished Anabaptist?" And like I said, right in the rib, and I went, "Oh!" And she said, "You're a heathen. This is beautiful." So the song ends, and I'm just sitting there in a comfy chair, and I said, "Ladies, what was that?" And in a very thick accent, the woman on the cello said, "That was Gershwin's Someone to Watch Over Me." And so, not having had enough the fist to the ribs, I leaned over to Agnes again, and I said, "I think it'll be better when the banjo player gets back."
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she...
Yeah, that's true. See, that's one of my pet peeves is when a symphony orchestra plays popular music, you know. It sounds like an elephant with a tutu dancing, you know. I mean, it's just not, it doesn't cut it, you know.
Yeah, but she hated me for several hours after that because I just kept going on and on and on. Because bless their hearts, they were playing really hard. And I just wasn't getting it.
I don't think there's anything for you to get, you know. A string quartet and any kind of popular music don't go together. It's you're mixing genres that.
Well, yeah, right. In many ways,
I'm a musician, and I'm,
in many ways, it reminded me, Richard, of listening to. Well, wait a minute. I've got it here. Hold on. Just a minute. Just one second. It reminded me of this. It was that. It was so discordant. I screwed up. This will only take a second. Here he is. It reminded me of something as silly as this. And it doesn't get much sillier than this. Stand by.
How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Now, that is from a sorely lamentable album called Sebastian Cabot Actor Reads Bob Dylan Poet.
I thought it was...
A recitation with... string accompaniment.
Yeah.
And it's like Captain Kirk doing Rocket Man, okay? It's something from Sesame Street. Some of these things are not like the others. Some of these things do not belong.
I know. It's like, you know, I love Dr. Bill as a teacher, as I said before. I get stoned when I listen to him. He is so good. And yet, you know, Dr. Bill and I disagree about music because to me, pops is just nowhere. I mean, I can't handle, you know, an orchestra playing.
You know, I like to think I'm pretty open-minded. I can listen to anything short of Southern Quartet gospel. And that's just too big an ass-whipping for me to take, Richard.
I'd like to hear more of it, Bob.
Oh, go to YouTube. Look up Happy Goodman Family. You'll be done.
Okay. I mean, I can't evaluate it because I just haven't heard enough.
Well, God forbid I not help you. I mean, you know, that the horn is a full service effort in reaching out and listeners and you know, members of the family all helping each other. Let me see if I can just do a bit of
what's the name again?
The Happy Goodman Family. Okay. I forget what her name. What her name was, but Mama Goodman had hair up to Jesus. I mean, let's see. God, I'm trying to find it. Vestal Goodman. Vestal Goodman. Okay.
Vestal.
Vestal Goodman.
Is that like a Vestal Virgin?
Don't even take me there. Here we go. And I mean, they packed churches, National Guard armories.
Heaven has described its beauty so rare, so one day.
See, it just sounds like cats being killed to me.
Well, it sounds like white people trying to be black.
Well, there may be an element of that too. For my part, it was just I had 2-3 years of night after night playing that garbage.
Isn't that terrible when you're on the radio and you have to play stuff that you hate?
Oh. The nights that the calls of, Bob, would you play Jesus, This Is Jimmy for me one time, just one more time? I just need to hear it tonight. It supplements my faith. Jesus, This Is Jimmy. No, I'm not kidding. there are people, probably Lottie, in the chat room who is cringing because he knows what I'm about to do to everybody. Check this out. Here we go.
Death follows night. Night follows day.
Now bear in mind, this isn't a cat killing, this is a goat killing.
World keeps rolling along. What will your answer be? What can you say when Jesus beckons you home? His name was Jimmy. He wasn't very old, about 10 or 11 years since birth. But you wouldn't call life for Jimmy heaven on earth. He lived in a big town in the north part of the nation. His mom and dad had forsaken him, so he had to sell newspapers to stay off starvation.
At least he wasn't selling his body to the night.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
that you had to play?
Every night. I had my very first radio groupie would call in every night wanting to hear that song.
Oh, isn't that terrible? I could hear it. That came off an LP, didn't it?
Yeah, and we didn't get to the good part where Jimmy's parents were out living the high life, living the night life. I'll never forget the first night I played that for Peter Godbold, and we had to follow it up with I Love the Nightlife, I Like to Boogie.
I haven't heard Peter in a long time.
No, Peter's just out there laying low and just being his own wonderful self. By the way, thanks to all of this that you got started, Richard. Ron and Raleigh just wrote in and said, I've been slain in the spirit, Bob. I'm crying in my Miller High Life. Hey, Richard, I got a roll, brother. I'm going to try to hit a couple more calls here. But you have a wonderful night. This conversation has been all over the place, and it's been fun.
Well,
and I will pass your compliments and your kind regards along to Dr. Bill next time I talk to him.
Oh, do that. I love the guy.
I sure will. You take care, Richard.
See ya.
Bye now. And, yeah, I'm going to try to wedge another phone call in here. Why not? Or maybe. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the musicale.
I'm sure I'll get hate mail, Jim.
You're just too much, I swear.
Well, he's not. Yeah, I haven't done it in a while. I'll play Jesus, This Is Jimmy all the way through, and nobody will be okay.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I just want to make a comment last night about the Academy Awards, and that was when they had Kirk Douglas on there.
And yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Incredible. And when and MSNBC made a note of this tonight, of what that man did for those people who had been blacklisted, like Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the screenplays for so many wonderful movies. I mean, Spartacus, for example. And Douglas had the courage not to use a pseudonym or a nom de guerre or nom de plume or whatever you want to call it, and put Dalton Trumbo's name up there on the credits. I mean, that man, I was just absolutely amazed to see him be able to get out there in spite of a stroke and infirmity.
And yes.
And basically be recognized. Well, he really wasn't recognized on the Academy Awards last night, but Chris Matthews did a piece on him tonight, and it was just incredible. We have so much to owe to people like him.
Well, and especially his courage in standing up when people like the filthy Ronald Reagan were, you know, Ronald Reagan was an informer.
Oh, yeah, he was T-something, T-34 or something like that. No, that's a Russian tank, but it was the same thing. But nonetheless, yeah, he was. He was a special agent for Hoover. And while he was in Hollywood making movies, he would make comments like, you know, when I was home on leave, and the military people would say, leave? Shit, you never left the damn country. What do you mean, home on leave? I mean, good Lord. I mean, even Colin Powell made a comment about it. I mean, talk about bullshit. That's the only word.
That's really the only word available, isn't it?
That's the truth. That's the truth. But I was very glad to see the King's speech took the best picture, and Colin Powell. Colin Firth was
best actor.
That's a wonderful movie.
And there were a couple of moments there. Some nice things were, you know, Hollywood understands the value of unions, and not so, and the actors, but more to the point, the people who work behind the scenes, the thankless folks.
Exactly.
And Gary Rizzo. Gary Rizzo won the Oscar for sound mixing on Inception.
Right.
And the guy, you know, any guy doing that job is after my own heart. You know, I love all the technical aspects of all this and the stuff that John's taught me. But it was beautiful when he made his acceptance speech. He said, "I think what's going on in Wisconsin is kind of madness right now. I've been a union member for 30 years, and what the union has given to me is security for my family. They've given me health care in a country that otherwise does not provide health care, and I think the unions are a very important part of the middle class of America. So I stand strong behind any of the union members in this country and in any other country. All we're trying to do is get a decent wage and have medical care."
Exactly. And one more quick thing here. When this idiot in Wisconsin is doing what he's doing to union bust, what he's trying to do is, number one, destroy the revenue stream of the Democratic Party, and also decline the foot soldiers of the Democratic Party who get out and get people to vote. That's a part of this thing. That's part of his plan.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I don't disagree in one iota.
And Chris Matthews brought that out tonight, too. He did. And I will say this for MSNBC. They do the best they can to bring the word to the people. They do. I've got to give them a lot of credit.
Well, part of the day. The what goes on earlier in the day with Morning Joe is a totally different story. That's just a right-wing love fest.
Well, this morning, and one last thing, I made fun of Kirk Douglas this morning.
Sick bastard.
Well, you know, what goes around comes around.
You got to hope. Jim, thank you very much. Got to get out of here, my friend.
Good night.
Bye now. Yeah, really got to get out of here. The clock on the computer's gotten short from the clock on the wall. It is time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Maybe we'll catch up with some. We will. We will certainly catch up with some more on Monday tomorrow. The Rick Smith Show is on the way now, as is our buddy Spike's interview that I told you about earlier in the program. Check both of them out. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to all who make this happen, especially to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.